your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Monday night, December 29th, 2025, as we record this new show. It's our final episode of 2025. A lot happened this past calendar year for the Chicago White Sox, and we're going to share our top 10 moments of the calendar year based on page views of you podcast listeners visiting SoxMachine.com, social media engagement, and of course, podcast listens. A couple of those moments have been more recent, but we're going to be driving down the 2025 memory lane. Also, there's a curious rumor about Yoan Moncada and the Chicago White Sox, which we'll address. Joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, gentlemen. And by the way, happy, or I should say, merry belated Christmas to both of you. I hope you had a wonderful time. Of course, Jim, it's fun for you and for our podcast listeners that have kids. I can understand it could also be a little bit stressful in what to get them and the tally as far as the bill gets pretty high buying gifts for kids. But how was it for Mini Margulis?
It was good, successful, I should say. This is the first one where he's been aware that presents are a thing and Santa's a thing. Also, his birthday is Minnie Minoso's birthday at the end of November. So we can take it easy on the Christmas front because he just got an onslaught of gifts. Like, he had multiple birthday parties because families live in different areas. So just, he had lots of gifts streaming in over the course of weeks. So we could take Christmas fairly lightly. In fact, like, one side of the family said, like, let's hold off on gifts for him until, like, let's have like a mid-spring surprise or something like that. So he just doesn't get overloaded and then, like, you know, have nothing for 10 months a year. But we were at the State House in Tennessee. He blew past the governor, just left him hanging on a high five, walked up to Santa and told him what he wanted. And I asked him what he wanted. He said, like, I told Santa I want a yellow train with a blue windshield. And I was like, and I asked my wife, like, do you know what he's talking about? Like, nope. And, like, he kept mentioning this yellow train. Like, I have no idea what this is. It's vague. So I went to, like, the toy store that has the biggest train selection and just kind of scoured the entire thing and said, like, this is the best guess I have. So I bought it, you know, part of a Brio train set for those who, know. IYKYK Brio train sets, and relief. Right. Opened it up, like, yellow train, like, good, because that was the only yellow train, the only thing that fit the description. So I lucked out in that regard. So survived the first brush with you know, Santa disappointing him by not getting, and it was a reasonable ask. It was just I did not know what he was talking about. Had to retrace steps, do some detective work, but in the end, got it done.
Well done, Dad. Well done. How about you, James? What'd you get for Christmas?
Most relevant bit for, like, this podcast is that I got an example of my family knowing me well, I guess, is I got two separate different radar tracking devices. And I'm weighing, like, whether I should keep one or against the other, or if I should just take both the spring training and kind of test the reliability against each other to some degree. But that felt extremely, that my family knows who I am, that I have to cross compare pocket radar versus, you know, one of its competitors. But I guess the audience will benefit at the end of the day to what I shake out there.
Nice. So are you doing a product review? Is this incoming this spring? James Fegan product reviewing baseball equipment?
Maybe. It's just like it'll have to be patient because I don't want it to be like initially like one episode is Noah Schultz is sitting 97.99 in his first spring session. And our next podcast is like, so actually there's a an issue with over seduced velos with one of these technologies. So I feel like I'll have to get a feel for it with time out of the gate.
I was curious how you calibrate it or no,
Right.
in like a backfield setting, when you don't have Statcast to compare it to, like how you know?
Sneaking a glimpse at the TrackMan laptop that might be open, probably. So if that's the case, how much do I need the radar attachment as well? But that might be one way.
But this could be a thing, James. This is how you can get free gear from all these baseball technology companies. Maybe we can get you a torpedo bat so you have one on hand. Traject, if you're listening to this, ship one to James so you could try it out. I don't know if
I
it'll
think
fit
they've
into his
advanced beyond
house.
the giving away expensive technology for exposure portion of their trajectory, given that they had a whole like hotel room set up at the winter meetings that we came across.
Oh, did they? I missed
Yeah, it was
that.
in the
I
hotel
missed
across the
that.
street from where
Okay.
the event was being held. They had like a whole suite or something blocked out for people to come up and see demos or something like that, or talk to teams. So I don't know. I feel like they're swimming in deeper waters than giving us stuff for free.
Well, if
Traject the
you are
home
a
game.
baseball tech, yeah, there you go. Yes. If you are a baseball technology company, send James Vegan free stuff. He'll do product reviews for you
I
guys.
mean, the White Sox are already flanking us by having like social media people try to hit off Grant Taylor, which was great content. I watched it all, but
It was. Yeah, she did a great job. The social media admin made contact. That was fantastic. For me, I got something cool from my wife, who reached out to an artist who does custom Jordans, and she got me Sox Machine Jordans. So painted the Cog logo on one side and then the other logo on the flip side. And these are so nice. I don't think I could wear them, Jim. So I know we're gonna be having our big meetup in August in Chicago to celebrate 20 years. So I'm gonna have to find somewhere behind me in the wall, maybe that empty space for those that watch our videos of the Frank Thomas autograph that I have for me. But yeah, maybe this is our new thing. We get some Sox Machine Jordans out there.
I always figured Sox Machine shoes would be concrete.
Oh, God. Wow. Wow.
But
Oh,
no, those are
man.
very cool. Yeah, you need the glass box on the wall.
Yeah, I do. That's a good idea. Like right
And you should
behind the
also
other.
sign them. Sign your own memorabilia.
Sign them? Would you guys sign them? Maybe. I'll
Sure,
think
my
about
signature
it.
sucks though.
Yeah, Margulis could be tough. You would have to
Yeah,
practice
I would
very
definitely be the
hard.
guy who just wears them like every day thoughtlessly.
You
Like, yeah.
should. You know what? Maybe I'll make you some. There you go. Another product review. You can review custom Jordans, custom Sox Machine Jordans. So when you walk in the press box, I know Scott Merkin would be impressed, James.
I know he would notice and talk a lot, whether his true feelings about it would be obscured.
Well, let us know what you guys got, your White Sox themed gifts for Christmas. If you guys got any new jerseys, I'm sure some of you got some Colson Montgomery jerseys finally. But yeah, let us know in the comments section what White Sox gifts that you got this holiday season. Some White Sox news that we'll touch on here. It's not really news. Let's go with the latest rumor for the Chicago White Sox. If you didn't get a chance, if you go on SoxMachine.com, Jim wrote up a very nice piece about trying to project the 26-man roster as of today. And Jim did address what the Cincinnati Reds did by signing J.J. Bleday and making a trade with the Miami Marlins for another outfielder. Does that necessarily mean that the Reds are out on the Luis Robert Jr. trade sweepstakes? Who knows? Maybe, to your point, Jim, it's a lot cheaper option to go in that direction for Cincinnati. But this latest White Sox rumor on social media from Francis Romero that Yoan Moncada is getting attention, so old friend is getting attention from several teams, and one of those teams is the Chicago White Sox, supposedly. James Fegan, what are you hearing? Is there smoke here? Yoan Moncada, White Sox, possible reunion?
Basically, what I heard was close to no interest in a reunion from the Sox side, which isn't no interest, is just close. So not a refutation of what Francis said. I mean, theoretically, they need to check in on what the price point is for all over the market to understand it. But at least from what it was described to me, it seems highly unlikely. And I think at least for me, my first reaction to it was like, they don't need a third baseman as much as they need a right fielder or just any outfield help at all, or a starting pitcher, and their resources are a little limited now.
Yeah.
I think there's certainly a world. I mean, certainly last year, Yoán Moncada was outproduced Miguel Vargas. He could theoretically be a short-term upgrade if you want one. And dare I say, some distant scenario where he's a flippable trade asset at the deadline, despite all, not a major one. Hey, you're kind of looking for your next Gage Zeal level acquisition off of it. But from what I, it was downplayed heavily to me, and seems more like them checking around than something that's developing actively in any way, and also just doesn't seem like a big priority for the roster at this point. It didn't seem like they were itching for a reunion on his way out of here, and it doesn't sound like things have really changed with how they perceived it at this point. But he is a talented player. He did have a solid year last year. I think he's someone you have to be cognizant of the value of. I don't see that quite lining up with what they're trying to do, or where their assessment was of him on his way out of his, ooh, what was it, 8-year
Oh,
run?
yeah.
Long time, like
Yeah.
2017 and 2024. Like, they had a
No,
long view of
they
this
didn't.
player. I think it's run its course still, but
Yeah, no,
fun to see him
that's
out there.
good stuff, James. Thank you. But Jim, back to like your 26-man roster projection piece. I think it's pretty clear, especially from the comments section at SoxMachine.com, unless Moncada or anybody wants to play right field for the White Sox, maybe out of position, the White Sox could be interested because that outfield right now, as it stands for the White Sox, could use some help.
Yeah, it's pretty thin, even with Robert there. That's the tricky thing with like a Luis Robert trade, is that it's not good with them, and it's even worse without them. Just because, thanks to Andrew Benintendi's Achilles issues and the White Sox kind of thinking that they're going to phase him out of left field plans, at least as a primary guy, there isn't anybody. Yeah, Brooks Baldwin, you have Derek Hill, but like nobody is a lock, whether it's because of health or talent, to play 100 games in an outfield position. Like, even if they brought back Mike Tauchman, which seems, kind of likely, or at least, a very feasible fallback as the White Sox assess all their options, like, he might not play 100 games, like, because of the leg issues that he had, the knee surgery. So he would be a great bet in that regard for looking for some kind of fixture in the outfield. And I guess they have maybe a little bit of consideration to give to Braden Montgomery, and just making sure that like nobody's in his way, and you earmark a position for him. But like, that's not anything that requires 2026. Yeah, it's a case where like if they get Tauchman in a 1-year deal or whoever, like Blade, I thought was a sensible post type project the White Sox could take on. I guess they've taken on Everson Pereira in that regard, but like anybody who they bring in for this year can be bumped aside should Braden Montgomery just come out blazing and just demand a spot by May. So yeah, we haven't seen the outfield market really shake out. There's a reason why Robert is getting interest despite his salary and despite his track record, just because there isn't a whole lot of upside on the free agent market. So yeah, it's I think the White Sox are at a disadvantage just by having no like high minors slash major league talent in the outfield, to where when you're trying to hunt for it when you have nothing, it's like the worst time to buy a car is when your car is broken down, and you'd rather just not have to invest in one, and you'd rather just take a hand-me-down that's $500 and hope it can last a year until you get some savings in that regard. And I think it's the White Sox are in that position with outfielders, to where it could be pretty grisly unless either Robert hangs around, he's healthy, or Brooks Baldwin's second half is the bats average under non everyday use, and his defense improves in the outfield. But yeah, it's pretty ghastly, and it kind of overshadows what's a promising catching core And then like an infield that makes a lot of sense, even if, you know, it might project poorly or it might not work out the way the White Sox hope, but like Vargas, Montgomery, Mydroth, Murakami, like you have reasons to play all of them at the positions they're playing. If it fails, it's not because like it was a poor plan. It was like it was worth trying. And you know, adjustments will have to be made. Yeah, the outfield's the gross part.
Yeah. So any upcoming rumors, any whispers, gossipers that correlate the White Sox with outfielders, that I would take seriously for the White Sox because they could use some help.
Yeah. Moncada, like I wonder if they're like they want to sign him so they can not play him some more. Like let's just sign him for a year and then bench him for like
Oh,
aside
man.
from like 12th inning pinch hit appearances just to really drive the point home. I do wonder like if Moncada last year like in a weird year last year because he's an above average bat but like his defense according to both DRS and Statcast cratered at third base. But he did like play through injuries and he did like return from the injured list in a timely fashion. And I do wonder if it's like the 1 year contract lifestyle is really like what he has to get used to just because like there's some physical talent there, but just if teams are thinking like, oh, he's not the most motivated to get back, as I think the White Sox, based on the way they handled him over the last 2 weeks of the 2024 season, like I think they were disgruntled a little bit with his very long rehab process and the mysterious ways they referred to like setbacks without any details. That perhaps it's a case where just he will have this kind of itinerant employment for the rest of his major league career, just because, he seems to play more when there's more to play for.
Well, we'll see what happens next for the Chicago White Sox, at least when it comes to the roster. But great conversation for all those that have chimed in on Jim's piece. If you're listening to this podcast and you haven't checked out that projected 26-man roster feature on SoxMachine.com, definitely go ahead and check that out. And let us know in the comment section of that post what differences that you would have. I'm curious, like, I think you make a good case about Corey Lee and carrying three catchers for the White Sox and just where they're currently at right now with their current 40-man roster construction. But as I mentioned in the intro of this podcast, it is time for us to say goodbye to the 2025 calendar year. This is our final episode. The next time that we'll have a Sox Machine podcast, it'll be 2026, which is going to be a very fun year for Sox Machine as we'll be celebrating the 20th anniversary of SoxMachine.com launching all those years ago, Jim. Pretty soon, SoxMachine.com will be able to drink legally.
It's
but I
already
wanted
done
to
it.
ask you, it's already done it. Yes. It's a Midwestern blog. It's had a few. But I wanted to ask you guys before we get into the top 10 moments for the Chicago White Sox, what was your guys' favorite 2025 moment, whether that's personal or White Sox, Jim?
Well, I think the Pittsburgh meetup was really cool. Like, I was happy to get back there. Just, based on the way the 2026 schedule, unfolded, like can't take for granted such a lovely timing and a great setting and great venue for meeting up. So that was a pleasure. It was cool seeing one of our Swedish readers and listeners, Ole Sox, Magnus came in for his first White Sox game. Fascinating to watch a White Sox game with a person who'd never seen like never been in a major league stadium. Like that, it was having been in so many ballparks and so many settings and such and kind of getting used to everything, just somebody who had not in who got into baseball from afar, just kind of on a lark, picked the White Sox at random, kind of at least when looking at teams, and then just finally goes to a first game after following it for years and just taking in the scale of a major league stadium in person. Cool to see that. It's cool when you can see fresh eyes on something and something that either is faded into the background or maybe just didn't notice yourself because you just treated it as lights and noise and everything else that kind of turns into a din. So that was pretty awesome and made an impact.
How about you, James? I have a feeling I may know what your personal 2025 moment was.
What do you think?
Let us know. You survived the marathon. I saw it with my own eyes. I gave you a high five. You made it.
So I guess somewhat related to that, I think like the actual thing that I enjoyed most in 2025 was right after the marathon of going and being the best man in my childhood best friend's wedding and a speech that I worried about for really the entire year up to that point. And then did like a lot of frantic rewrites and restructuring, like within 16 hours of having to give it going over pretty well. That was nice. But to bring it back to the marathon, like, you know, we get the medal and I was like sheepish about, like, you know, my wife was telling me like, oh, you should bring the medal. You should show it off, or you should wear it. Like it's something you do, should have pride in it. And I like had it in my like bag. I think I even put it in my check bag, 'cause I thought like a big metal thing, like in my carry on, would like get me flagged in security, only for when we got on our flight to go, 'cause we had to go to London to then Spain where the wedding was.
No,
is that my flight is just full of like British marathoners who are going back to Chicago. So like every fourth person on my plane is wearing their marathon medal. And if anything, it would be funny because they're all like people run marathons all the time. So they have a certain build generally as a population. And it'd be fun as someone with a different build to kind of just flip on my medal and like say, what's up, guys? In an American accent on top of it.
They give these to anybody.
What kind of looks I would get. But to tie it back to the White Sox, I think a favorite moment or an enjoyable moment in the clubhouse was definitely showing Davis Martin and getting his reaction to the picture I had of an issue that happened in training and then propped up during the race of nipple chafing and the related stains on my shirt that it produced. Because like Davis, like you realize like baseball players are all explosive movement, like training. And so they do very little like low grade cardio, basically what marathon running is. But like one day, like Davis like decided he was going to like run poles or was jogging around the warning track and ran like a mile. He's like, I just wanted to do something different to like flush my system. I was like, oh, I didn't know if you were running. It's like, 'cause I do distance running. It's like, yeah, I mean, I ran like a whole mile. That was probably like as much as I felt like doing. I was like, oh, I ran 10 earlier today. And he's like, what the hell is the matter with you? And I was like, that's not the half of it. And I showed it to him. And so by then, the two of us are talking and, you know, we're giggling. So it's clearly not like a serious conversation or an interview. And like Len Casper walks up to like start chatting with us as well. And I was like, Len, do you want to see a picture of my bloody nipples? And Len left shortly after that. So that was one of my favorite moments in the clubhouse for sure. So it's all tied together, really. That stretch in October really had a lot of spiderweb or connections to the rest of my year.
Did they record your speech?
My mother like recorded like half of it. There's a script.
Okay.
I was very of the, this was a moment for its time and place. It doesn't necessarily need to become like a big thing of content.
That's okay.
Widely distributed. 'Cause like, it's a lot of, you know, childhood stories with my friend, but yeah, you can hit her up. She'll probably turn over what she has. If you twist my arm, I'll share the script with you.
Okay. I'm just curious. You're really proud of it. So
more just like it was weighing on me the whole time. It's like you have a sentencing hearing in October and you're thinking about it for all the year. And then when you get there, you realize they tell you your probation. So it's the relief thing.
How long was it? Like minutes wise?
Probably like 5-10 minutes. Maybe it should have been 10 minutes if I didn't get too amped up and start flying through it at portions, but That's life.
Well, for my personal 2025 moment, speaking of our international fans, Magnus, it was awesome to meet Magnus. David, all the way from Scotland, also visited Chicago, got to hang out with him and his family, learn and, you know, the difficulties as far as following the White Sox all the way over from from Scotland, but that was great to hear those stories. So for our international fans that are planning to come to Chicago to watch a White Sox game, definitely hit us up. I'm in Chicago. James is in Chicago. If Jim is in Chicago, or come visit for our 20th birthday bash in August. It'll be great to watch that game with you. Yeah, because it was really cool, as you mentioned with Magnus, Jim, just remembering that. And the White Sox won. It was a good game. So you got to see the fireworks. So you got to see everything. And that's what you want for your first White Sox game ever in person, is to be a good game and the White Sox end up winning. I had some pretty cool trips this year. Bozeman, Montana, and completely eating it during whitewater rafting as I was sitting in the front. There's a great picture where as we're dipping down the wave, it's like frame by frame by frame. You see me, you see me, you see me. Now you don't see me as the big water just engulfed me. So that was pretty fun. That was maybe my favorite trip this year outside of Pittsburgh. And of course, New Orleans is always a good time for eating and drinking. And of course, hanging out with you guys in Orlando during the winter meetings. Always a great time. Now it's time for top 10 moments for Sox Machine. So what I did was combining page views, so how many people we had going to the website, social media engagement, and podcast listens. I came up with the top 10 moments of 2025. And we're going to start with number 10. I kind of need the David Letterman drum roll. Number 10, Andrew Vaughn getting traded. Jim, what do you remember most from that particular moment?
I think the bigger shock was Andrew Vaughn getting optioned. Just because that put the writing on the wall in terms of like, well, you're looking at a non-tender next year. There really are no false impressions about where this is going. And this is more like, I think, a last-ditch effort for viability before the White Sox turn the page and look for a different plan. So I remember there being a little bit of a telegraphing just because like Vaughn was playing every day, but Tim Elko took all of his playing time at first base. And it's like, well, if he's not hitting and he's not playing defense, what is he doing? And then we found out like he's going to be playing in Charlotte. So I think like that was, I think, more of a shock to like the way the White Sox did things. But I think there was a little bit of surprise in terms of just somebody wanting Vaughn. And then it turns out the Brewers, you know, at least had a notion of maybe how Vaughn could function again. But yeah, having him go to Nashville, AAA Nashville for the Brewers, talking him with them briefly and just being like, yeah, just it's been weird. It's weird to be traded. And then, you know, he has a nondescript like week or two in Nashville, gets called up because Rhys Hoskins gets hurt, and then, you know, turns into a punchline for the White Sox because of course he's a you know, second half and postseason hero to the extent that the Brewers had postseason heroics. So yeah, it was a, you know, there is no, I think, like official close to the previous White Sox chapter, just because, you know, Vaughn's gone, but Luis Robert's here, Andrew Benintendi is still here. So it's like, there, it's not quite closure in one respect, but it is, I think, probably because he wasn't under a long-term contract and they hadn't, they were going year to year. Just, it was the easiest to undo and move on from. And it certainly was a shock. I think just the fact that the White Sox, even though they didn't seem to believe in Tim Elko all that much, they still were like, yeah, it's more worth it to get the defense and see what he has versus, have Vaughn just continuing to run out there with no results.
Yeah, Andrew Vaughn, 48 games for the White Sox, according to Baseball Reference, was worth -1.8 WAR. In 64 games with the Milwaukee Brewers, he was worth 1.3 WAR. Just batting average. Vaughn batted .189 with the White Sox. He batted .308 with the Milwaukee Brewers, a gigantic OPS difference, a .531 OPS with the White Sox and an .869 OPS with the Milwaukee Brewers. So lots of conversation all summer long. Every time Andrew Vaughn made a big play, had a big game for the Milwaukee Brewers, they loved it. I think he got a bobblehead, didn't he? Or is he getting a bobblehead?
Or a t-shirt. I think he got a t-shirt. Yeah.
They were pretty quick to jump on the Andrew Vaughn bandwagon. We'll see how Vaughn performs with the Brewers in 2026.
You know, the funny thing, though, is that, like, for as well as he hit, like, it's still Yeah, the best argument, the most convincing argument is just regression. Yeah, we'll find out next year. But just a matter of like when you look at Vaughn's season line, 254, 307, 411, his previous 2 years average amount, 252, 306, 415. So basically the exact same thing. It's just like a simple you go from a 100 OPS plus to 99 OPS plus after all is said and done. So perhaps he just took the most circuitous route to where he normally gets. And so I'm fascinated to watch him next year just to see if the effects do last, if he withstands being planned around in the National League and part of the Brewers versus somebody who could just kind of play when Pat Murphy felt like it was a good opportunity and just kept playing him to more playing time. So like, yeah, he will be somebody I'm watching just to have more of an answer because like he's not particularly expansive himself in terms of what's different. And I think it was so far removed from what he did with the White Sox that the Brewers really had no comment because it was just it was a flyer on him, and then it turned out to be more than they could have imagined.
Well, number nine in our top 10, lots of call-ups by the White Sox in 2025, but Kyle Teal getting called up. James Fegan, what do you remember most when Kyle Teal finally got the call?
What I remember most is that I was glad that we got him on the phone for like an in-depth interview in Charlotte like a week before he got called up. That was like great timing, and honestly, he was mashing during it, so he like was explaining a bunch of things that he was working on and like were going right. So from a beat writer perspective, it was perfect. It kind of fits in like there was a little bit of odd timing with all their catcher promotions throughout the year. Like initially when Corey Lee sprained his ankle, I want to say early April, they call up Omar, they purchase a contract of Omar Narvaez from Double A Birmingham and add him to the 40-man roster. And he plays like a week and they call up like Caro less than 2 weeks later. And it kind of like Caro was already kind of like he played well enough where at least he was kind of thinking he was a candidate for to break camp with the team. Really, it seemed like, given the fact that he probably would have been called up last year if he had been healthy at the end of the season, I think that's legitimate. Obviously, he wasn't getting called, like there would be service time incentives for holding him down. It was a weird like roster maneuvering where Omar Narvaez gets called up in the DFA. Teal was a little bit similar because Corey Lee finally gets healthy in late May and he gets called up. He gets activated in late May, and then the Teal call up is June 6th. So Corey, and that sending Corey Lee back down for that after being up back on the roster for like 9 days, that's the way they burn his last option, which they're probably going to burn that year anyway at some point. But it was like, what was like, why not just, obviously you can't just like have Corey Lee on the IL forever. You burn the option eventually, but like the idea that 9 days beforehand, we just need Corey Lee back, and then we just wind up handing over the keys to Kyle Teal anyway, which I don't know. Roster, like it's there's no way I can really see them navigating around it other than just trading Corey Lee, which might maybe next year he proves useful enough and plays enough positions or so few outfielders that reveals itself to be something you didn't want to do anyway. There was weird timing with all the catcher call-ups, like the way they would bring up a veteran in a way make you think like, well, they're not calling up that guy anytime soon, and then he comes up like a week and a half later with all of them, which is now not a memory of it, but postseason was that they were actually considering sending Caro down as the corresponding move when they called up Teal because he was struggling that much defensively, and they want like had specific things they wanted him to work on framing wise, and there was a little bit of like, should we just send him down to Charlotte to work on this? And instead, they went with the platoon. And I think that probably also, if that had happened, we already have this debate of like, are they going to trade Caro or which one do they like more? I think that probably would have framed the discussion in a much very straightforward manner if they called up Teal and made him the starting catcher and sent Caro back down. I mean, maybe I'm too married to like how the 2019 Nats won the World Series, but I think there's a world out there where like a two catcher setup like keeps them both healthy over time. I don't know if it keeps them both happy long term if they're both become as good as I think they
Sure.
can, but I think about them a lot. This is what I guess I should say. They're interesting case studies to me, both of them on different ways, where one is kind of viewed as the toolsy higher raw upside guy, but that's actually the older one. But the younger one is the, you know, precocious baseball feel one that they feel is a little bit less toolsy. They're interesting compliments where I kind of would like to just watch their careers side by side and compare and contrast them. But they might just be too good for that to be one, like the best use of value for the White Sox roster. Like right now you could be like, certainly if Carroll was like in his prime and like you could fetch you a haul, you'd be like, damn, it seems like you should definitely pull from the catching position and give it to the outfield if you can in any way, looking at this current roster. And I think similar problems are probably going to pop up for the White Sox down the road that one of them should be a pretty good way of addressing, but they're so complementary of each other stylistically and skills wise that I would love to just watch them side by side for a while, but we'll see.
Well, number eight, another call up this time, Grant Taylor getting the call, which was a curious time as well, because we thought, Jim, that Grant Taylor was going to be developed into a starter. He's not surpassing three innings. And then all of a sudden the White Sox pivot. What do you remember most about this call up with Grant Taylor?
Well, one note of the Teal thing is that his first game was the Magnus game. And so yes. Magnus ended up getting a Kyle Teal jersey because he's like, why not? And so we'll see, you know, alongside how their careers develop, whether the Kyle Teal jersey proves to be a wise investment for somebody. First game, like first game for both of them, first White Sox game for both. It was a good call. Grant Taylor, speaking of guys you just talked to before it happened, like he was at Rickwood in early June. So I talked to him briefly, just kind of checking in and saying like, how's the relief thing going? Cause that's a surprise. And he's like, yeah, I guess they just want me to do it. And kind of talking about how his arsenal is adjusting and how like the changeup is like, you know, has to be more or less shelved because there aren't a whole lot of reasons to throw it when you're only throwing like 20 pitches a game. You know, he's learning about how to basically set up hitters for kind of two pitch sequences versus three or four over the course of, you know, four or five innings as he's planning to extend over the course of the season. So another one that the White Sox kind of telegraphed by sending him out of the rotation despite like no injury concerns, pressing, giving him every kind of relief assignment. Like here's high leverage. Here's two innings. Here's back-to-back days. Are you feeling good? Cool. Like they were just kind of checking off all of the items before calling him up. And then like, you know, over the matter of like, I think 10 days or so, or like, you know, like it was like a couple weeks, I think, called him up and he spends the rest of the season with the White Sox. And like, yeah, just fortuitous timing to just catch him in the very small window where like it was happening and there didn't seem to be any kind of signs that a return to the rotation was going to be in the offing, at least over the course of the remainder of the 2025 season.
Number seven, Adrian Hauser getting traded. What do you remember most from the Adrian Hauser era with the White Sox, James Fegan?
The era, him being, I guess, like just reeling off good starts a lot. When I remember, it was like his last start before being traded. Also, like a lot of things are flooding. So let me put it in order. He was scheduled to be like the start their last game before the trade deadline. And up until whenever they actually scratched it, they were just like, oh, everything's normal. Why would we move him? You know, we're just focused on winning games. And then like when they finally did scratch him, they were like, yeah, we're not crazy. And then he gets moved. So because of that, he got very reflective post game, like his what wound up being his last start. And I was like, man, it'll be kind of awkward if he just goes out here another week and just gets shelled. It's like, screw this place. But he went like, he obviously struggled a lot the previous season. He got like DFA'd. I think he finished the season like not on a roster. He went through like a pretty sizable mechanical overhaul. He had like had a kid recently, like this past year, and like was away from his family for a lot of it because he was doing spring training with you know, Texas. And it was for him going through that and also where he was at in his career, like it was a very big leap of faith for him to like opt out of his minor league deal. And like, you know, basically he knew he was pitching well in AAA and like his numbers were, you know, affected by a couple of one-offs, but It was like guy who was bad last year who has like a 5 ERA in AAA is declaring free agency. The idea that it would lead to, you know, one of the best stretches of his career, and now a, you know, a 2-year deal with San Francisco. You know, he it's rare that I think a lot of times, and understandably, athletes are like, when they're going on what winds up being one of the best runs of their career, just like thinking like, yeah, we're just going to keep building for here, or this is new normal, or we're just going to keep getting better. He very much realized like both this was a very good stretch and this was a very well-timed stretch for me, and I took a lot of risk and it paid off. And so it was cool to see that happen for them. Something I felt was not cool to see happen for him as he pitched is after he got traded and he was pitching for the Rays and he was warming up. He was throwing a bullpen when the Rays were on the road in Seattle, and he's a native of Oklahoma City, and he was so excited about them winning the title that year. He did all of his bullpens with the White Sox in his Shea Gilgeous Alexander jersey. But when he did that in Seattle, all the Seattle fans think like he's intentionally like tormenting them by like waving this Thunder jersey in his face, like, oh, just a nice Oklahoma City guy who's happy about his team, and said he seen him get like a torrent of abuse like online. It's like, oh man, like, yeah, it sucks that Seattle got their team taken away, but this is just some dude, like, Oklahoma City's been there 25 years, most of Adrian Hauser's life. He goes out there, like, nonchalantly, like, yeah, I love my team, we're the champs, I'm throwing my bullpen, and people just, like, screaming at him. Like, oh man, sucks that he walked into that. Seemed like a nice enough guy. But he had a very good year for himself that, you know, hopefully is, you know, only going to continue to bode well for his career.
Number six, Luis Robert Jr. stays, Jim. We spent a lot of time this past July. We're still spending a lot of time wondering if Luis Robert Jr. is going to get traded. But what do you remember most of the trade deadline and the White Sox deciding to keep Luis Robert Jr.?
Well, I think we lived through, you know, something similar with the Garrett Crochet trade, just in terms of it being like the primary point of focus for an entire deadline, and like it didn't happen, and you could kind of see why it didn't happen with Crochet. It was the demands for like the rest of his role for the season, and the White Sox realizing like he might have more of a market in the winter versus Robert being just the idea of what he can be versus what he is now, and the White Sox having the option. And you know, the White Sox, yeah, I guess a couple of takeaways from that is, one, like the White Sox, you know, they exercise his option at the end. Like there is like a little bit of doubt of would they actually do it. They went ahead with it. They lived up to the word in that regard. The other thing that's funny is that, you know, when it comes to Chris Getz and like one of his vocal patterns, I guess. And he has this thing where he'll say, a sentence, and I'll circle back and say, we do, like, you know, we think we're on the right path. We do, you know, just he'll circle back and with that, we do, I do, et cetera, to really emphasize a point. And Robert seemed to be like the guy who drives that. I mean, perhaps it's because like he does have to, you know, his job when talking about Robert is reiterating how much he believes in a player despite all the evidence. You know, maybe he's put in this position where he does, you know, have to voice some things that may not be naturally logical. But yeah, it came up a lot. Like, we believe in Luis Robert Jr. We do. We love the player. We do. And I think it came up like 4 or 5 times. And that's kind of how I noticed that Getz really enjoyed that kind of pattern. Now I think people have moved on to him saying understating when he means overstating. So I think that's now the new thing people use to poke fun of Chris Getz's rhetoric. But that was, I think, the first one in terms of if I were to do an imitation, that's why I built it around.
Number five, the Chicago White Sox draft Billy Carlson in the first round. James, what do you remember about that moment?
He is a confident young man. And, you know, if I got signed a $7 million bonus or whatever it was when I was 18, I think I'd feel the same. But I think I've made probably when I was like a younger blogger and people were talking about draft prospects, like, oh, he's got a lot of charisma. And I'd be like, what the hell does that matter? To a degree. And now I find myself as like an old beat writer and people are asking about Billy Carlson, and obviously the glove or the, you know, plus power potential is probably more important than any bit. But like going out there to Arizona and talking to him or listening to him watch interact with his teammates, I'd be like, yeah, this guy's a Riz King. I don't know if that bodes well to the to the what his long term projection is. But like, I don't know. I see like Timothy Chalamet interviews now, and I'm just like, that's basically Billy Carlson. Type of atmosphere I get of little scrawny white guy who very much is feeling himself, and everyone around him seems down with it too. Though as he, speaking of confident things, he said is that he got asked about his glove work and how he's so good, and he like on draft night in Zoom, and he's like, well, my mom's Latin, so I think it just comes naturally. I just like, I'm not gonna write that, but I guess you get to say it, right?
And I agree, says James Vegan.
Okay, man. I mean, like, things are working for you. It's your world. So, yeah. He's not going to, I don't feel like it's, we're going to get some, like, tell all interview in 15 years where he's just like, man, I just never believed I could hack it up there. I don't think that's what's going to, derail Billy Carlson. If anything does, because, when you talk to him, it doesn't sound like anything will.
I remember that I got the pick right in my last mock draft. First time. No, it was a very talented MLB draft class, especially in the prep shortstops. So I think the White Sox should be very happy with what they got with Billy Carlson. It'd be fun to watch Billy Carlson in his first professional year in 2026. Number four, Shane Smith, All-Star. So Jim Margulis, we go from Rule 5 draftee, don't know much about this guy, pumps 98-99 in spring training, has an outstanding April and May, and represents the Chicago White Sox in the All-Star game. What do you remember of Shane Smith, All-Star?
I remember wanting Adrian Hauser to be the All-Star rep just because of the novelty of like just showing up 2 months in, taking the All-Star nod, then going to a different team. Like that would have been just a, how do you explain that to future generations? And like, you kind of had to be there. There wasn't a whole lot going on. Adrian Hauser is really good. And he was the war leader for a good long while on the White Sox, at least when it came to baseball reference war, just because it uses runs allowed versus FIP. But it was, yeah, I was kind of hoping for Hauser. But Smith, like, my concern was, like, looking at his last four starts going into the All-Star game, gave up 22 runs over 15 and a third innings, and just everything was kind of going the wrong way, thinking that this is just going to be, like, another Mark Redman-type All-Star nod to where just, worst All-Stars of all time. You have Mark Redman with a 5.71 ERA and just being like, well, the Royals needed somebody. And seeing Smith's season up close and kind of marveling at a Rule 5 pick doing this well, and just kind of, just hoping for his sake that like the story just wouldn't evolve, because the White Sox needed somebody, that he'd go from this like awesome story of Rule 5 success to being like a laughing stock in a way of just White Sox are so bad. Shane Smith was their All-Star, but he handled his business in the All-Star game. He brief appearance, came out and scored upon, so that was cool. And then, like, rest of the season was fine. And he finished the season being above average, kind of threatened a no-hitter in his last start. There's a lot to look forward to for next season. And so I'm happy for him that, one, he got the All-Star game. And then, like, two, when you – the further removed you get from this year, and when you're looking back at White Sox All-Stars, you might be curious about like, he maybe has the kind of career where you think like Shane Smith was an All-Star. And then you look at a year like, he was decent. And you move on, which I think is, what you want if you are the lone team representative and you're picked because you are the lone team representative versus like a real All-Star toiling on a miserable team. So happy for him the way it worked out.
I would say that a no hitter on the last game of the season, the getaway day, when I had a flight scheduled for like 80 minutes after like final pitch, is the truest definition of threatening a no hitter than anyone's ever had. There were some cheers that might have crossed both sides of the beat writers' team coverage when that single hit to grass. No offense, it wasn't me, Shane. Wasn't me, but I heard them.
73 pitches over six innings. Like it was,
We were worried. Yeah. We were talking about how worried we are.
Yeah, combined no-hitter, he could probably still make your flight. Like, it's just a weird trivia.
Yeah.
Like, you know, send me Eisert's quote, email, and I'll patch it in. But.
Well, our next two items, if you're going to blame me with recency bias, go for it. But there's been a lot of activity with number three and number two. And number three, it is the Chicago White Sox signing Munetaka Murakami. And again, really recent as far as the White Sox signing Murakami, James. But what do you remember most in the last couple of weeks since we have been really flooded with a lot of interest, especially overseas in Japan, with the White Sox signing Murakami?
My refusal to take it seriously up until the bitter end that it was really a possibility. At like, it's a risk. Like, my assessment of it, like, when we were writing up for Fangraphs, is like, he's got elite power. Someone should take a shot at it. I don't know if I would say it'd be me, because I don't, like, have a ton of confidence individually that's going to work out. Like, someone smarter than me will have to see, like, what specific adjustments will be that will make him have enough end zone contact. But I still fundamentally thought he would get more than 234. Like, you had told me that his market was here, I'd be like, all the people, although even the reports, I was still like, oh, all right, like, they made a bid. You know, I know Keller wins in Japan and seen him, but we'll see. Even that, I was like, okay. But if you had told me, like, yeah, he's in the 230 to 40 range, I'd be like, oh, yeah, then maybe the White Sox are in. Got to confirm pretty quick. So, like, I don't think I totally biffed it for the most part. I was like, nah, whatever. I'm pretty sure I said in the VC, like, within a week of him signing, someone asked, like, what's the chance of this? And I was like, zero. To the point where, like, as we're at the press conference, there was a point where, like, you know, a Sox person was just like, I really just can't believe, like, how little got out. Like, it, like, there was no word of, like, this didn't leak at all. And I was just like, man, you guys are just, like, dancing in the end zone on me right now, I feel like. So, yeah, my bad on that.
Nobody thinks of you.
We'll have a lot on him going forward, but my bad.
Yes. Well, number three. Number three, Murakami, signing with the Chicago White Sox, brings us to number two at the winter meetings. The Chicago White Sox winning the MLB draft lottery and be selecting first overall in 2026. Tons and tons of engagement with this breaking news. Jim, you were there in the draft lottery room. What do you remember most of the White Sox winning the draft lottery?
Just how big their smiles were. Like, I hadn't seen Chris Getz smile like that, like, in terms of the smiles tend to be fleeting, I think, with him. And then it's like on to concerning topic number three whenever he's in a media session. So it, like, it immediately fades. But, like, he was feeling like Mike Shirley was feeling it. Like, yeah, I think, Mike Shirley seems ready to be this important. What's my takeaway from, I've seen his, media sessions, heard his media sessions, but I haven't, like, been in person. But that was a case where, like, he is ready for this. Like, this is the gift he always wanted. And, like, he couldn't, stop, smiling and talking it up. So the White Sox have really set the stage for this being a watershed moment in the franchise, and, you know, perhaps they are doing so because it is, you know, at least they have a pretty good idea of who is 1-1 right now, and you can speak to this better than me, certainly, in terms of how rare that is. You know, usually there's like a pool of, you know, a couple candidates, maybe, you know, top three. Sometimes it is wide open, like last year, like Eli Willett's going first. I don't think he was 1-1 on anybody's board. So I think, you know, just having somebody everybody knows as a front runner in Rock Chulowski, I think, makes it easier to pump it up versus being like, well, we have to figure out draft bonuses and figure out the best way to spread the money around. Like, end up in a Mickey Moniak situation to where, you know, it's more about money being spent elsewhere than, like, getting the best player available who's going to be the readiest, the fastest. Like, this, I think, is everything lined up to make a big deal of it. And the White Sox certainly did. And, You hope for their sake that they are validated or vindicated by the way the draft turns out. I hope for our sake we are, just because like it is a case where having a 1-1 unanimous 1-1 player taken and all the interest that generates going up to the minors, like, certainly benefits us as well from a traffic perspective, from a general White Sox interest perspective, from a out of town interest perspective. So they certainly have a lot of eggs in this basket, and so do we, and we will go off this cliff together.
When I go see Rochelowski in person in late February, early March for the College Baseball Classic weekend tournament, in which UCLA is going to be facing some of the SEC schools on their schedule, Grady Emerson will also be playing games in the Arlington-Dallas area. So I'll get a chance to see both of them that weekend and be able to report back on the top two players in the upcoming MLB draft. But yeah, tons of engagement when the White Sox won the MLB draft lottery, which brings us to number one, the number one topic for us at Sox Machine, and largely after the All-Star break, and that is Colson Montgomery's power surge. The videos, the social media engagements, reading about Colson Montgomery, bashing home runs. You guys love to see it. You love to read it. You love to hear it. I was shocked because he was not hitting well in AAA. Even Gene Watson, interviewing Gene at the end of the season, said it was incredibly rare to see a performance like this. But James, you were there. You got to see it in person. You got to chat with Colson many times in 2025. What do you remember most from Colson Montgomery's power surge?
The press box at White Sox Park is on the first base line. So you have a really like close or good side view. Mostly it sucks, but like you can see things. Like you can see a left-hander's like arm speed slowing down for a changeup like really well. Not in time to signal a hitter, but something to think of. I'm open to try whatever Sox players want as far as flashing my phone. We'll see. But you see like most left-handed home runs kind of go at you. You can see like the arc, like you can see the parabola kind of forming, and you're like, oh, is that going to go over the wall? Whereas it at least felt like Colson's home run off of Slade Ciccone, I think it was the Guardians start. I want to say that was the 451, the one that got to the concourse. It felt like you saw like an upward straight line that was still going up as it passed you in a way that just like, well, that's different. I believe I yelled a profanity at the time, but we're just out of being startled as it streaked by. I would still say, like, as much as that like showed he had like legit very excellent raw power, I thought that home run against the Nats in the final series where it was like a game winner and it's like this weird slobber knocker game where like Luis Garcia Jr. hit three home runs for the Nats, and it's an afterthought. Colson coming through in that spot very much like felt like you have a big time performer who can win games for you type of thing. And you don't want to like make every ninth inning home run like extra meaningful, but it was left on left too. And it also like came to mind when Jose Ferrer got traded to the Mariners this offseason, because that's who was off of, is a lefty who throws in the high 90s. Got a 4 ERA. There's some issues there as far as like what his best secondary is going to be, but like clearly a valuable arm because they got Harry Ford back. And saying like, well, the last time I saw that guy, he got messed up by the Sox lineup in both those games of that series. But seeing Colson like turn around 97 left on left, it was a memory that stuck out. Like initially made me think like, they think Jose Ferrer is this good. I've seen him get knocked around. But also like if this is somebody that, a smart pitching team thinks has like tremendous raw ingredients that they think is this valuable, and it's someone that Colson is still getting to, that only bodes well for him. As much as I was also anti people are making you wait, this is like, the newest trending topic, flavor of the week, when like torpedo bats were a big thing in the first week. And it's funny because like they basically came to the White Sox in the second half. We got like, it was like, a foreign movie like airing here where you get it 3 months later after it's been like a big thing elsewhere. Them being torpedo bats, all his home runs came after the torpedo bat switch, which you don't want to just say it's just the bat, but it seems like it would definitely was a catalyst for shrinking down maybe the axis of his swing and making him more compact and making him a lot better in the zone, and something that I'm a lot, like, you know, we've been sharing TrackMan numbers from last year a lot recently, is that something I think is super encouraging for Colson going forward, is that his end zone contact rate was basically average by the end of the year, which I think, like, we'd probably have given up on at this point this last year of him doing that. Like, I think both the draft profile for him and maybe the hope as things were devolving a little bit for him as a prospect was like, well, maybe this will be a guy who will just take walks and will hit for, you know, home run. It'll be like an ugly low batting average, but kind of like Joey Gallo-esque production from a guy who can play an average shortstop is really valuable, even if it's not like the monster middle or the order hitter that we thought. Whereas now is the issue is that just that he chases too much. And obviously his rate of contact when he does chase is pretty low, but that's pretty in kind for a power hitter. But what now the project is not like, oh, he's going to just going to get blown away by every fastball over the belt. And how much are we ever going to mitigate this issue? It's, we just need to get this guy to chase less, which one, like, he only had basically half a rookie season. And for the longest time, that was the thing he was good at offensively was plate discipline. And just the level of like 90 degree turn or 180 degree turn we've made in what his offensive profile and what task he has ahead of him from May to now is just so jarring. And the fact that he squeezed in 21 home runs in the middle of that in a really small piece of time with a lot of like, man, that ball was demolished, or man, that was a big spot, or man, he, you know, hit a Christopher Sanchez change up for home run, or, you know, whatever, I forget what exact pitch, but he was, I think he was the first lefty to home run off all year. You got him like verified a lot of ways that I wouldn't have anticipated in June, let alone a year ago, that it's 20 home runs seems like just fourth or fifth down and like crazy thing that he pulled off in the, you know, basically back two thirds of the season. I think it deserves to be the number one story. If not for just how important it is for the White Sox, just and how crazy it is, like that so many transitions were made in a short period of time.
I am looking forward to when we have Keith Law on the podcast. I feel like it needs to be a two-part series. One to talk about the White Sox prospect list for 2026, and also one like, so Colson Montgomery, let's talk about him, just because, you know, it is, yeah, I think him more than most prospects would be like, when did you see him last? Or when did your source see him? Because I like, he just changed so dramatically. And also I think, you know, we didn't talk about his defense at all, but I think partially like the concern about his offense and the viability of his bat and his ability to cover the strike zone was the debate was so loud that, like, thinking about it and thinking about like the times I saw him in Birmingham and Charlotte and think about like how I just wrote, like, yeah, his defense was fine at short. Like, nothing came up, like no plays flubbed. You didn't do anything sensational, but he'll handle everything that came to him. Like, just seeing that, you know, kind of in my notes or in my write-ups and realize like, oh, he might actually be a shortstop. Like, that might not be the problem. And, just because he looks so weird out there, like he looks out of scale. Like, he looks like he was rendered at 120% on the field when he's playing shortstop. And it looks unnatural when you see him like pursuing a grounder up the middle or in the hole. Like, it looks like, oh, somebody, you know, lets, you know, a right fielder loose in the middle infield and like get him back in the corner. But then you realize like, oh, he's making the plays and the arm's good. And he has like makeup speed with his throwing strength. So like, that's another fascinating aspect of him, is just because his offense was such a concern, we might've overlooked that. Like, he hadn't given reason to move him off the position yet, aside from just looking weird. And, you know, maybe having some mechanical issues to smooth out in terms of like gathering, you know, sequencing his hands and his feet as he's gathering a grounder, and seems like he ironed that out. So, you know, as we, you know, go into next season, and I'm sure like, you know, as Keith, you know, goes through his list and talks to his sources, like, I'm curious, like, what's his outlook now on Montgomery and how has it changed? Cause, you know, we were both on the same page last season. Like he looked terrible. Like he looked like it looked like he the White Sox were in denial about like a fatal flaw in his game, and like sure enough, it manifested itself in April. And then it's like the opposite of Frank Sinatra's That Life, like shot down in April, and then like he's back up in June. Like it really was a fascinating arc, and I'm looking forward to getting his third party take on it, and also like a skeptic's take to see like did he change that mind? If so, what else will it take? Like I think we could spend 45 minutes on the topic alone, so I got to figure out how to get in and out of that while leaving enough time to actually talk about the reason to have him on.
Well, for White Sox fans, they're really excited with Montgomery, hoping that in 2026, the combination of Montgomery and Murakami, maybe the White Sox have two 30-plus home run hitters that hit from the left side. So it's just not James shouting profanities when Colson Montgomery launches one, but maybe Murakami as well. It'd be a lot of fun to
bring
be
back
sitting
the goose
along the right field. Yeah, bring back
something,
the goose. Bring back
something to hit. Some promotion that a lucky fan can win if something is struck.
Maybe Brooks
his last
Boyer
team
can
was
find a new sponsor.
Owned by a yogurt company. Could they get like some big vat of yogurt for him to hit and put in right field that he can hit balls in?
You do have the train car back there, but with Miller Lite, you can't do a mug because that's what the Milwaukee Brewers do. So, challenge to the White Sox marketing team. Find something, a target, maybe an actual target out there in right field for Murakami and Montgomery to aim for. But those were our top moments in 2025 on Sox Machine. Let us know in the comments section what are some other moments that you guys remember, or if you would like to debate and you would like to have something else to be in the top 10. And also let us know what your personal 2025 moments were in the podcast page on SoxMachine.com. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine podcast. If you just discovered the show, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen to the show and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. If you do check out our videos, please hit the subscribe button. Greatly appreciate it. You can follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. And if you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com/products, where monthly plans start at $5. We also have annual subscriptions to give you a discount. We have additional tiers of support as well. So as you heard James chiming in, sending rumors, sharing what he is hearing about certain free agents, and what he's hearing from White Sox officials. If you want some of that inside information, we do have some spots open in the Sox Machine Veterans Committee that you can inquire and join the VC and join the group chat and have direct access to both Jim and James. Again, if you are interested and want more from us at Sox Machine, go to SoxMachine.com/products. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, your home for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.